question.
Yeah.
Call this meeting to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but we will have one soon, hopefully. And I'd like to make everybody aware of the fact that we're going to have House File. We are not going to hear House File 1037 today. And with that, we have a presentation for the commission from the Commission for Deaf and Deaf Blind and Hard of Hearing, Minnesota. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Hartnett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deaf Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. We're a governor-appointed commission that advocates for equal opportunity for people that are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing in the areas of education, employment, technology, healthcare, and we promote civic engagement. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to testify here today. We really appreciate it. We know there are very scarce resources that your committee has to allocate, and this is a jobs committee, and this is a presentation about jobs for people that are deaf and hard of hearing. People that are deaf and hard of hearing face many communication barriers that prevent them from getting and obtaining full employment. There are only two jobs programs that are funded by the state, and you're about to hear from two of them that are dedicated to people that are deaf and hard of hearing. Just a few basics about employment for people with disabilities. Only 22% of people with disabilities are engaged in the workforce, as compared to 70% of the population without disabilities. We need strategies for overcoming the barriers that people face, and these two groups have come up with dynamic strategies that have resulted in the folks that are served by them getting employment. I'd like to introduce Jennifer Anderson with the Minnesota Employment Center for Deaf and Hard of Hearing, and she'll be talking about the great work that you are funding currently.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here. My name is Jennifer Anderson. I am the program coordinator for the Minnesota Employment Center for people who are deaf and hard of hearing, and I'm here to talk about why the Minnesota Employment Center, or MEC, is a one-of-a-kind program. Since MEC's inception in 1993, we have served over 1,300 deaf or hard of hearing Minnesotans. It is the only program of its kind in the state. MEC helps deaf and hard of hearing people obtain and maintain employment. And MEC is unique because all of the staff are fluent in American Sign Language. They are able to assist both employers and employees reduce or eliminate communication barriers. Most of our clients are not fluent in English. MEC also helps employees advance in their jobs, as well as we provide technical support to solve those immediate work issues that arise. The communication barriers that deaf and hard of hearing people face are significant. MEC helps people to overcome them. This program helps people who are deaf and hard of hearing who are hard to employ. It helps them find jobs and keep jobs, and for employers to find good, reliable employees who can help them with their bottom line. You will see on the handouts we've provided that we have over 500 employers in the state of Minnesota that we have helped. So it's a real win-win for Minnesota. For example, last year, one of our clients was working at Burger King, and he informed the MEC staff that he was laid off. But MEC staff followed up with his supervisor, and she found out that the employee had not been laid off. It was a misunderstanding. So fortunately, he was able to return to work. Without MEC staff's involvement, he would not have shown up for his scheduled shifts, and he would have lost his job, all because of a communication breakdown. He would have been dependent on public assistance because of the employer's reluctance and fear to hire deaf people. So it would have been made it difficult to find a job quickly. As of last year, MEC supported 86 deaf and hard of hearing consumers. The average wage was $9.82 an hour, and the average weekly hours was 29, with a total of an annualized wage of $1.2 million. Exactly $1,281,435.58. So the return of investment is $4 for every dollar invested in MEC. The bottom line, it's a great investment. I would like to now introduce Ray Kane. He's a manager at the TJ Maxx store in Brooklyn Park. He has hired a total of 8 or deaf or hard of hearing clients, of which 6 of them continue to work there and receive support, mainly in the form of communication from MEC.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
My name is Ray Kane, and I work for TJ Maxx Corporation as a manager. The group, MEC, she mentioned reluctant to hire deaf people. As a manager for the company that I work for, it's tremendous communication ability to have them help us. Policies, training, just everyday things that we take for granted as hearing individuals and employing hearing individuals. The opportunity for them to help us communicate effectively to the deaf or the hard of hearing associates that I have in my team, to benefit changes, to on-the-job training. There are some people that, you know, they know their clients and they know their abilities and what to do and how they work effectively. There's one individual that I was kind of reluctant. I'm not sure if I could, you know, put him on the books and hire him. They said he can do the job, and he's one of my best associates right now in the back room processing. With their help and their support, he's actually moved up to more responsibility within the company and actually became team of the quarter for our company, which is a big opportunity, and he actually became associate of the quarter. That is all based on the support that I get through MEC. Writing notes back and forth to communicate is very difficult, but if I have an issue with an associate or an opportunity to train them or develop them, to have them grow within the company, they're there every day to support us. Just recently, we had a schedule change which would dramatically change the process of my back room, and actually with the associates I have, the 8 deaf people that I have working for me, they came in, signed, spent about 15 minutes with them, and everything is great. They're ready to go back. The change of schedule, not a hitch in how it went off. So with their process, coming in and helping me as an employer is, I can't even explain it to you guys. It's a tremendous benefit for us. And the more that they help us, the more we employ. Currently, in one of our stores, I had one associate start there. Mary Jo came in and asked me to give her a tryout, so we did an internship position with her, and I hired her, one of the best associates we have with the backroom processing. Because of that, we hired 2 more individuals back there, so we had a total of 3. We actually became one of the best backroom processing teams within the district and the region. They're on time. If any have any issues, they're there to support me, but also support the team that's there too. I mean, it's once again, I can't stress how important it is, because when I talk to you guys now, it's different from what I can actually speak and communicate, what they actually understand based on, you know, basic English, you know, and how I interpret something based on how they interpret something, and it can come off totally different based on my body language, you know, how they, I can even hand them a policy and procedure, and it's going to be different from what they interpret and what I interpret it. So it's very important that they come into our stores, or actually with our team, to interpret things and help us out with policy training. On-the-job training is by far beyond anything I can tell you. It's very valuable for us to employ the associates in the store.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, now I'd like to introduce Greta Palmberg from the Vector Program for Deaf and Hard of Hearing Youth.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I want to thank you for this opportunity to talk about how the Legislature for Communication Access helps our young adults leave the education system and be ready for those entry-level employment jobs. Last year, I was able to sit down with my colleagues who teach deaf and hard of hearing at the high school, and we just were really frustrated about the ability of our students 15 to 18 to get that entry-level position. We looked at the population we were serving, 100 deaf and hard of hearing students ages 15 to 18. Out of those 100, 12 had competitive after-school or summer jobs. That's it. So without this work experience, without access to these entry-level jobs, these students are unable to compete with their hearing peers to enter the job market. Jennifer talked a lot about the obstacles for employment, so I won't go into those again. But there really is a discouraging picture of deaf and hard of hearing young adults having high unemployment, underemployment, low rates of full-time employment, and really low rates of participation and retention in post-secondary education. Our program is committed to changing these statistics, and we're succeeding. Mary talked about the slide for the national employment of 22% were employed who had disabilities. Last year, our program of our graduates, 89% of our deaf and hard of hearing students either had jobs or were going on to post-secondary education. Our program is part of the Intermediate District 287. We serve students 18 to 21, and currently one-third of our population is deaf or hard of hearing. What makes our program different, our special education program different, is the funds that come through legislation that is a collaboration with DEED. These legislative funds allow us to have intensive communication to provide job coaching, career classes, job interviews, creating resumes, have work experiences, and most importantly, do something that is beyond the education scope, and that's seeking employment opportunities after school, during the summer, and even after graduation. What we've created here is an innovation between what's provided by education by simultaneously inserting employment services specialized from the deaf that usually they get after they graduate through the VR service system. We're doing it at the front end. By this collaboration with DEED, we're doing what the government expects of us with our public funding, being cost-effective, leveraging resources, maximizing services, having co-located services in order to give the students the experience they need to ensure faster employment after graduation. Some may not even need VR services when they graduate from us, but those who do will arrive at vocational rehab ready to work at their most independent level. So how much money can the state save? Well, to give you an example, one of our average deaf students who graduated recently went into the workforce. Before he got his job, he was receiving $630 monthly on SSI, received $90 on food stamps, and received MA insurance. After graduation, Vector placed him in a job earning $14 an hour. He got full benefits, and he's been at that job there for almost 2 years now, off SSI, off food stamps, off MA. With an investment of $330,000, this model program will create better education and employment outcomes for deaf and hard of hearing students and more productive citizens for the state of Minnesota. Continue this funding for communication access so we can avoid the national average of 78% unemployment. Allow us the opportunity to graduate 89% of our students who are ready for post-secondary education and employment. And to illustrate my point, I would like to introduce one of our current students, Zachariah.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Hello, my name is Zachariah. My last name is Anab. Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, Hello. This is my name, Sign Zach. I am a Vector student. I got to America 4 years ago. I immigrated from Syria. Really, my goal is education. I would like to earn a BA to improve my quality of life. When I graduated from high school, I was just not ready for college. I went to Vector because it was going to help me improve my skills so that I was college ready. I've been taking ELL, and it's immensely helped me improve my English, my grammar, my writing skills to get me college ready. Vector has helped me with a lot of different things in the area of employability skills. They helped me look for jobs, know how to look for a job, fill out job applications, and know how to do interviews. During high school, I only had one job experience through the Conservation Corps of Minnesota, and now I'm working independently at Crown Plaza. I do have a job coach there, but I'm learning to become more independent and will hopefully continue to learn those skills. Currently at school with MEC, Christine Adams, who is the representative right over here from MEC, which is the Minnesota Employment Center, I'm hoping to find a job for the summer that I will be working competitively as an independent employee, not with a job coach. And the communication is critical for me to have sign language interpreters at my school to help me catch up and be at the same level. I feel like the benefit is just immense. If I wouldn't have had Vector after I graduated from high school, I wouldn't have been able to find any kind of job. I just would have felt lost. Vector has been an immense part of my life.
Thank you for listening to us today about the importance of supporting communication access for people who are deaf and hard of hearing and deafblind.
Now we'll have a presentation from Elm Transitional Housing. You guys want to come on up?
Not sure if we're in good morning or good afternoon, but Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm executive director of ELM, Transitional Housing. I'm also a founding member of the National Coalition for the Homeless and the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless and MICA, the Metro Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program, which is in your committee, as well as just to briefly touch on the Housing Trust Fund and the Bridges Program. You should have received or are receiving right now a package of information that has ELM, and there's a number of pieces in here that I'm going to refer to in just a moment. God has blessed us here in Minnesota with incredible partners, including you as legislators, the faith community, providers, people that have experienced homelessness, local government, for-profits, nonprofits, in developing a humane and cost-effective way to prevent people from becoming homeless, and to provide shelter when needed, and to rapidly transition people back into housing as quickly as possible so they may get jobs again or maintain their jobs. And we've been creating these national models since 1983. Representative Clark, as well as many others around the table here, have been actively involved in helping us create the legislation, including Representative Gunther, the chair. ELM Transitional Housing began in 1983. We are the model for the state legislation that we passed here in 1984 and a model for our federal legislation. We serve over 6,000 people in the metro area each year that are at risk or experiencing homelessness. In 1988, we passed one of the first state housing trust funds in this state. We also passed in 1991 the Bridges Program, which is a program designed to help provide rent subsidies for folks with mental health issues. And then in 1993, as an initiative from Governor Carlson's office, we passed the Minnesota Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program. an incredible model of redesigning how we were going to do prevention of homelessness in the state for families, individuals, and youth, and then how we were going to rapidly exit people out of shelters, back into housing, into the communities, and back into jobs. This has been a model that has helped us redesign our work in Hennepin County, which Marcus will talk a little bit about in just a few moments. But it's been a national model, and hundreds of communities across the country are now utilizing the models that we've developed here in Minnesota. Now, the reason that these models have worked so well is that we've listened to people that are experiencing homelessness and heard what would have prevented them from becoming homeless and what would assist them to get back into housing and get the jobs that they need. Now, you can see, if you opened up this package, that you will see that we've continued to have increases in the number of people experiencing homelessness. Now, that sharp increase has happened just over the last couple of years. And during the middle part of this last decade, we were pretty much flat because we were preventing people from becoming homeless and getting people back into housing. Certainly, all of us have felt the impact of the economic crisis, and it's had an impact on people being able to maintain housing and jobs. The next sheet in talks about the impact on how the types of wages people are making in jobs in Minnesota and what it costs to afford housing in the state. And I encourage you to look at that both on the state level as well in the metro area. But basically, we have this disconnect that's happened for about three decades, actually, between how much it costs for housing and how much you can make. Now, when I was growing up in the 50s and the 60s and I was going to school, working, loading semis for UPS when I was going to college and competing and training for the Olympics, I could pay for my college, I could pay for my apartment, I could pay for my transportation, and I still had spending money. That's not true anymore. You cannot work a part-time job and afford housing or pay for school now. So we continue to have people that are at risk or experiencing homelessness. So as a person of faith, I believe very strongly that you listen to people experiencing homelessness, and then you treat other people the way that you would want to be treated if you were in that situation. And again, as a person of faith, I believe that how we treat the least of these, our brethren, is how we treat our God. Then I think the second key piece is that we've created a very flexible funding source so that communities can design their own response to how people are at risk or experiencing homelessness. And as you can see, the Family Homeless Prevention funds many, many communities across the state. You can see all the communities on the backside. 80 of the 87 counties are currently funded through this program in designing a program to meet the needs of people experiencing homelessness. And we combine public, faith, private, nonprofit coordination of funding. If you take a look at these two stories very quickly, it'll talk a little bit about, you know, how those resources have worked in the different communities as I continue to talk, because you can read faster than I can talk. The third point that's really critical is accountability. The expectation is that we're going to prevent people from becoming homeless, that they're going to pay their rent, that they're going to get a job, that their children are going to be in school, and that we're not going to duplicate other resources. We're going to utilize existing housing in the community, primarily from the for-profit scattered site in the community, and use mainstream resources to help people get jobs, get back the children in school if they're not in school, and make sure that they're accessing the resources that they need. The fourth point is that it's cost effective to have Family Homeless Prevention, the Housing Trust Fund, and Bridges Program. I just want to very briefly, and I have a whole copy of what Rob Allen, the Deputy Chief of the Minneapolis Police Department, testified at our Shelter and Transitional Housing committees in the Department of Human Services on Tuesday, but let me just briefly read what he said about the cost effectiveness of shelter and transitional housing and prevention. Minneapolis is no different than the rest of the communities throughout the state. When our citizens see someone lying outside, they call 911. Depending on how the caller describes the situation, the dispatcher will send police, police EMS, or police EMS and fire rescue. There is a tremendous cost associated with all of those calls. The good news, though, is that there are a lot fewer of these types of calls in our state because 3,500 men, women, and children were in emergency shelter or transitional housing last night in Hennepin County, primarily in Minneapolis. Fewer citizens call the police out of concern for a homeless victim of crime. If homeless shelters and or prevention at a cost of between $10 to $35 a night are not available, we end up sheltering them at another location. I want you to hear what he says about what those costs are. When a pair of beat cops must process one person to spend the night in jail, the cost of officer's time plus booking and a bunk is over $500. One person for one night. If we transport that person to the emergency room, a workup and night at the hospital costs taxpayers $2,800 for one night. If we bring that person to detox, it costs taxpayers $192 a night. We know that in order for change to come, homeless people need to access social service providers who can assist in long-term change, and that would be in prevention and getting people back into housing. Again, you have those two stories. Carl is a World War II vet. My father is a World War II vet. And he lost his housing to a fire and ended up being in a nursing home, came back and moved into the community very close to where he used to live, but was not able to afford that house. Through prevention and through rent subsidies, we were able to keep him in his housing so that he could live most of the rest of his life in his community before he had to go to the nursing home and passed away. The other story is about Deanna, who was in the shelter and went through our rapid rehousing program as part of the Family Homeless Prevention Program. She was finally diagnosed after many, many years of never being diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury. She had been the victim of a domestic violence situation. And when we got her the correct help, we were able to get her into permanent supportive housing, and now she's moved out to Maple Grove in a for-profit development by Duffy Development, Maple Ridge, and is now in Section 8 housing. So we can really assist people in preventing people from becoming homeless and assisting people to get back into housing as quickly as possible. As you can see on both of these sheets, in 2010 you have the state statistics in regards to prevention and rapid rehousing, that it's very, very cost effective to keep people in their housing. The average for a rental deposit and rent payment is between $421 and $516 to keep people in housing. For shelter for one night, it's $36 for a single person, or over $1,000 a month. For one family of four, it's $118 a night. So with prevention and rapid rehousing, we can save tax dollars by helping people stay in their homes and then help people get back into housing and get back into jobs. Together, with God's blessings, we can. And we will afford to maintain a humane and cost-effective system to prevent homelessness, address the immediate needs of people that are experiencing homelessness, but immediately assist people to transition back into housing, jobs, and other services that they need. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue.
Hey. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marcus Klemenko, and I work for Hennepin County's Human Services and Public Health Department as the Program Manager for Housing and Homeless Initiatives. We manage the various housing services options as well as homeless programs in and across Hennepin County. I'm here on behalf of the federal state county partnership of the Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program, FHPAP. The FHPAP program is probably, isn't that redundant, FHPAP program? I think it is. FHPAP is probably one of the smartest ways that we spend money. It is efficient, integrated, and direct. This program has drawn national attention for its innovative approach and cost-effectiveness. The program has an impact on both the front and back door of homelessness. The front door, homeless prevention. Homeless prevention provides a short-term financial help or legal assistance to help keep people in existing housing. It is more effective and less costly to assist people in keeping their housing than it is to try to have them regain it. The target population for this program is people who normally can afford their own housing but are at risk of losing it due to an unforeseen financial crisis. The program is funded by a mix of state, federal, and county dollars. The FHPAP Collaborative works with organizations that cover virtually all neighborhoods and cities throughout Hennepin County. Here are a few examples of our partners. We work with IOCP, Interfaith Outreach and Community Partners in Wayzata, that works with the west and northwestern part of Hennepin County. PROP, People Reaching Out to Other People in Eden Prairie. St. Stephen's Human Services in Minneapolis, as well as CROSS, Christians Reaching Out in Social Service up in Rogers. We work with SEEP, VEEP, ICA, PRISM, Legal Aid, Homeline, STEP, We Can, and Elam Transitional Housing. You could probably do a rap. And those are neighborhood organizations that are out in the community. So this is not Hennepin County doing this. These are the organizations that we work with. Hennepin County's program helped over 1,100 households in 2010. 95% of these households who received assistance were stable for at least 6 months after receiving assistance. That's 95% of households. The average cost was $875 per family, or $610 per adult. Compare this to an average cost of a family in shelter at $5,000. The back door, Rapid Exit. Rapid Exit helps homeless families find and secure housing. Despite efforts to prevent homelessness, there's still people who lose their housing and end up at an emergency shelter or in our secure waiting. Rapid Exit strives to get people out of shelters and back into stable living situations as soon as possible. It's unique because it quickly and efficiently assesses the specific housing barriers that people must overcome and gets them immediately referred to services that address this issue. This program is integrated and efficient. It helps get people out of shelters and into stable housing rapidly. We have a central intake, a single point of access, which is a key component and one of the reasons it's a national model. Services are provided by nonprofit organizations, and they act as credible intermediaries, a must in this competitive housing market. And then there's a citizen-based advisory committee, which assists in program and planning and implementation. So at times we link our FHPAP program with Housing Trust Fund or Rapid or Bridges, but I'm not here to talk about that today, although I could talk about how well those sometimes work and how those are also critical programs. I'm just going to focus on the FHPAP. Hennepin County's program helped almost 1,300 households leave homelessness for permanent housing. 94% of these households maintained housing for 12 months, and 91% of the households did not return to county shelters 6 to 12 months after the case was closed. The average cost here is approximately $1,100 per family and $850 for adult homelessness, or for adult households. So again, compare this to one episode of homelessness at $5,000. The numbers are phenomenal. It's a much smarter way to allocate limited resources. It's also a very effective approach. So let me give you one example of integration, and this is one I heard this morning from a family from Eden Prairie.
Marcus?
Yep.
If we could kind of, can you?
Yep.
We got a couple.
I'll do it in a minute just to give this example, and then if there's questions.
Super.
Joan and Mike rent a townhome in Eden Prairie with their two school-age children, ages 17 and 15. They've been Eden Prairie residents for over 10 years. It has been over a year since Joan was laid off from her work, and although unemployment benefits were just 50% of what Joan used to make, this family was able to keep up with their rent and bills for the last year and a half while Joan looked for work. Joan has been unsuccessful in her search for a new job and lost her unemployment benefits 3 months ago. For the last 3 months, Jim's checks from his full-time job as an assistant manager of a local business have also been garnished for a medical bill from 2005 that they were unable to keep up on once the unemployment benefits ended. The garnishment ended last month, and with creative downsizing of other expenses, this family could have been able to pay their rent and move forward. Unfortunately, they were already behind their rent, and they received an eviction notice from their landlord, went to court. They had 1 week to pay the balance of their rent plus $250. We're not talking about thousands. We're talking one month's rent, $250. And if he didn't pay it, they'd be homeless. So not knowing what to do, they went to their church, referred them to call PROP for help with their rent. They'd never used any type of assistance from the county or PROP before. In fact, what I found interesting is they'd revealed as we were talking about this, they used to donate to this organization such as PROP in the past. So unable to receive help from the county emergency program, they went to PROP, they got their funding for FHPAP for a 1 month's rent, and it prevented them and their kids from becoming homeless. PROP was also able to help them with food and gas to help them make it to their next paycheck, and we've got a family who's still in housing. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Marcus. Susan, are there any questions for the presenters there? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you much. Thank you much. All right, I believe we have quorum. I'd like to gavel our meeting into order. Mr. Sanders, have you had a chance to look over the minutes?
I have, and I move approval of the minutes.
All right. Sounds good. All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. I believe we have Representative Maloney. Mahoney?
Maloney. Call me Mullery.
There's an in-between of the two, I think, we came up with there. So, House File 1110.
Hi. I'll bring both just in case.
There you go.
I Mr. Chair, committee, I'd like to move House File 1110 for passage and taxes, I believe it is. Mm-hmm. Yes. A little history on it. I've got multiple testifiers that can explain it much better. This is probably the, I will mention that in a minute. Anyhow, House File 1110 is kind of a cleanup bill to the angel investment credit that was done last year. Groundbreaking stuff from Minnesota last year. We put $55 million over 7 years into a system that does a 25% tax credit for angel investors. Angel investors are wealthy individuals that invest up to $100,000 into small startup businesses. I told you I had a lot of people. This is a cleanup. And last year, there was some questions about how interns were going to be paid. The bill itself called for a 175% of poverty wages for a family of four. It was found out that some people thought that was what the intern should make, which is about $40,000 a year, I think it is, $40,000 or $45,000 a year. And there, so there was a reluctance. We had some conversations about interns should be unpaid, and we came to the agreement that it should be 175% of minimum wage if you're going to be an intern, which turns out to be just under $13 an hour. We had conversations about there's a $2 million cutoff and a $4 million cutoff, and I will probably ask Mr. Nelson to explain that a little bit more, but I'll just leave it at that. And the other one was the interns, and the funds. Oh, yes. The way the bill was written, it excluded, because of the wording in it, not so much the intent, it excluded funds, small investment funds, such as Rain Source Capital. If what this bill does is says, cleans up that language and says that if there are three people that are actually private investing in the angel investment, then they can still be in a fund, three people or less. And if I'm getting that wrong, Mr. Nelson will correct me. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Nelson. But before I do, you know, there's been a lot of credit given to me on this angel investment credit being passed last year. No bill gets passed here without a lot of help. And the man sitting to my right, Mr. Jeff Nelson, crafted it, sat through multiple legislators arguing with each other, multiple persons, and was a voice of strong reason. So I want to publicly thank him for his work. So Mr. Nelson, is
Mr. Chair,
be
a
little clear.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, before your testimony, I just wanted to ask, and maybe one of your testifiers can respond to this, Representative Mahoney. A lot of us supported the angel investor tax credit last year, and I'm just wondering either if you or some of your testifiers can speak to, I guess, the limited amount of jobs that were created in the first year of the angel investor tax credit. If I saw the paper accurately today, we spent $7 million to create 45 jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We can all speak to that, and I'll let any of the testifiers speak to it. Essentially, it's a startup. It's 6 months. I don't know that in 6 months you're going to create the hopefully 45 or 45,000 jobs in that short of a period of time. So it does take time to work. 47 jobs in 6 months, I thought that was reasonable at this particular time. But it will take some time for it to work itself through the system and for them to grow. Typically, small businesses, startup businesses, don't get into their strongest hiring until the third or between the third and the fifth year.
Representative Paymer, you have a follow-up? Oh, all right. Sounds good. Any other questions? All right. If you'd please introduce yourself and state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Nelson. I work for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I'm the coordinator for the Minnesota Angel Tax Credit Program. Representative Payton, if I could speak first to the question about the job creation. I think an important part about this program is to note that it was signed by the governor just last April and launched by our department in July. Certifications then started for businesses and investors and funds, and then slowly investments started. Most of our investments didn't really take place until like November and December. So when we look at the dollars flowing in here, they didn't flow into the last couple months. Then on December 31st, those businesses that did receive investments were required to report on the investments that received and the jobs they created. So often we had businesses that were reporting within weeks of receiving cash. I don't think, and the gentleman to my left here can easily probably explain to you that within weeks of receiving cash, you don't go out and hire one or two or five or ten people. It takes time. This program is really laying a groundwork for future businesses, future Medtronics, future 3Ms. Representative Mahoney sort of went through the three different points. I'll just reiterate very quickly what they are in this bill. The first point is, within weeks of launching the program, I had a number of calls from businesses that had interns as employees, temporary employees. Yet there's no provision in the bill for any temporary employees. There's no provision for interns. And they were telling me, I'm going to have to let these interns go because I can't pay them $18.55 an hour. So working with Representative Mahoney and others, we've come up with an alternate proposal that interns need to receive at least 175% of minimum wage, which is about $12.69 an hour, and we think that's a reasonable compromise.
Mr. Nelson, was there any discussion, also Representative Mahoney, about talking about what the average wage is for current employees or potential current employees, or and then make an adjustment in that realm rather than having discussions like individual business owners?
Mr. Chair, was there any thought to lowering or raising the 175% of poverty wage? No, there was no conversation
okay.
about that.
I was just wondering, from the potential of looking at it from taking each potential separately, maybe depending on where they are geographically, within the state, or that would happen to make some for people wanting to participate or not. So,
Mr. Chair, The focus of the bill was to hire people with a lot of letters behind their name, and most of them wouldn't go to work anyplace for 175% of poverty. So we made that adjustment so that if you were doing something different, a lower technology, it still got you to, I think, what is it, 38,000?
Correct.
38,000, which is the atypical wage, and it's not looking to make plastic widgets. It's looking to make the next medical device, and that takes a lot of training. So that's kind of at the low end of where they're going to start.
Okay. Thanks. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members. The second part of the bill is dealing with a discrepancy in the bill, in that in order for a business to qualify to participate in the program, they can't have raised more than $2 million in equity financing. However, there's another provision in the bill that says a business can raise up to $4 million using the program. So we've had a number of businesses that have been sort of caught in this trap of $2 million, $4 million, and it's really led to some confusion and to some very disappointed businesses and investors that thought in 1 year that they'd signed up for a program where they could put $4 million into their business. They did part of it in 1 year, then they get to the next year, they find out they're no longer qualified to participate in the program. And we're trying to, through this change here, rectify that. To my left, I have Mr. Doug Ruth. He's the CEO of EarthClean, and his company is an unfortunate example of what has happened here. Mr. Ruth?
Good afternoon. My name is Doug Ruth, and I'm the founder and CEO of EarthClean Corporation, founded 2 years ago. We're based in South St. Paul, Minnesota. I founded EarthClean to change the way the world fights fires. We have a very innovative technology that's cornstarch-based that we have proven is 30 times better than water or toxic foams and retardants that stop when you're putting out a fire. It's an amazing technology that will go a long way to saving firefighters all over the world and stopping fires. 2 years ago, we started to raise money. Over the first year, we kicked and crawled, and we were able to raise angel money of about $1 million. And last July, the angel tax credit hit. We were excited about it. In the next 6 months, we actually raised another $1 million. We really cut our funding time in half. As Jeff had indicated, we raised most of that money, actually $900,000 of it, in December. And the deed office, by the way, did a phenomenal job of turning around applications in days, not weeks or months. And from my perspective, they were moving not at the speed of business, but at the speed of the entrepreneur. And it's because of that we got the money last year. So out of the $1 million we raised under the angel tax credit, $900,000 of that qualified. So essentially, $225,000 in credits went back to our angel investors. That's all we've used. If you look at the bill, I'm allowed to use up to $1 million in angel tax credit. We had an offer come in 2 weeks ago for $1 million, which is why I'm here today. And we reapplied to be certified under the tax credit, and we were informed that EarthClean no longer qualifies. I'm like, well, how can that be? I've only used $225,000 of the tax credit. It's because we've already raised $2 million. But if you look at the bill, it says we have up to $1 million in tax credit that can go out to angels. We've only used $225,000 of it. If you look at the bill, one side says we can raise up to $4 million. So here I'm thinking I've got $2 million more in angel tax credit. This morning, and I'll be happy to show you my BlackBerry, I sent a note to the investor saying we don't qualify. Today at 4 o'clock, I was supposed to be going up to north part of Minneapolis to pick up a check for $1 million. That's not going to happen today. You talk about the jobs. I was really appalled when I read the newspaper today regarding the 47 jobs. Because when we wake up every day, we're creating innovation. You know, and success to an entrepreneur in a business like ours, an overnight success, it's like 10 years. And that's how we look at things. Okay? But what you have to realize, in the last 18 months of the $2 million I've raised, I don't manufacture anything. I do very little research and development in-house. I outsource it all to Minnesota companies. I have a manufacturer in Plymouth that does all my manufacturing. I have a company in White Bear Lake that does a good portion of my R&D work. EarthClean alone has reinvested $1.8 million of our angel money back into the Minnesota economy. Of the $28 million or so raised in angel capital last year under this plan, you got to realize most of that is hitting the street in salaries. A lot of companies like us are outsourcing programs, so other companies are benefiting from jobs. So as we saw today, there was only 47 jobs created, but what about the wages we created and the jobs for all the work that was outsourced with all that money? I bet you it's pretty significant. I don't know the statistics. So I asked two things. Number one, let's clarify that $2 million, $4 million, and let's make it $4 million. And the other thing, if it's possible, to make it retroactive so I can go pick up that $1 million check. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ruth. Representative Clark, you had a question?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was trying to follow up on your question. I don't know if I understood the answer. And this has to do with, and maybe the last gentleman can help us too, but the 175% of federal poverty guidelines for a family of four that an intern is allowed to make, and an intern can be either a student or a graduate who's no longer a student, I guess, but they're in a temporary position. So this is not a permanent job, right? This is a temporary job.
Representative Maloney.
What does the amount, what is that? I just didn't hear, I thought I heard something about $35,000. What is the amount that we're talking about here?
Mr. Nelson?
The minimum wage for a full-time permanent employee of these businesses must be making 175% of the poverty level for a family of four. In 2010, that was $18.55 an hour. What we are proposing in this legislation is that an intern, a temporary position, someone just out of school or in school or just out of school, must make 175% of the minimum federal wage. So it's 175% of $7.25 an hour, which turns out to be $12.69 an hour. So it's just a somewhat lower wage for an intern than it is for a full-time employee.
And Mr. Chairman, so can an intern, well, this $12.69 an hour, what is that per year? I guess I could do the math, but do you know?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, per year I'm not sure how you would do that because they can only work, they are limited to no more than 6 to 9 months. So $12 times 2,000 would be about $24,000 a year, I would suspect. But again, it's I fought very hard to make sure that it was a temporary job. They could not do an intern for 6 months and then turn around and make that intern lay that intern off for a month and then hire that intern right back for 12 more months, 6 more months. So that basically skipping around that. An intern is an intern. They're there to learn from the business and then go out and get a job wherever that job may be. Or in the case of some, they get hired at the company. But an intern is an intern, is a temporary employee.
I think
Representative Clark?
Thank you. I got a little help from the staff here. I guess for the $12.69 an hour, it becomes about $26,000 a year, and for the regular employee, it must be $39,000. So that person could become an employee of that company then, is that right? They would be able to, at the full rate.
Representative Mahoney?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, after their 6 months, at any time in that 6 months, 6 to 9 months, yes, they could.
Okay.
It's not saying they can't, it's just that they can't continue on as an intern beyond that 6 to 9 months.
Okay. I think I understand that now. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and the reason that I was so adamant about that is I've heard too many stories about interns being strung along for 9, 12, 18 months at their $9 an hour. And it's just not appropriate. If we're going to put tax dollars into it, they should get a decent wage and actually get a job.
Representative Mullery, you have a question?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Roof, you said going to North Minneapolis to get a $1 million check, the only person I know up there that has that kind of money came in with you and is sitting behind you back there. And he moved out, in case you didn't know that, out of North Minneapolis after he created all of the foreclosures around the country.
Actually, it was north of Minneapolis.
Oh.
All right. Would you like to continue on to your
I think we have another testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more point here that we're going to make in this bill, and that part of the legislation last year requires that all investors in a business must be natural persons. That also requires that all members of an investment fund must also be natural persons. We've run into a number of instances where we have funds that would like to participate in the program that have non-natural person members. What we're proposing in this legislation is to allow such funds to participate, even though we are not going to change the requirement that all members who receive the credit must be natural persons. And I believe the policy behind the natural person requirement is that the angel investing is often viewed as like there is an angel. There's actually an angel person. And that person isn't just providing money to a company, they're providing guidance and mentorship to that new company. And we want to ensure that via this program that there are such mentors in Minnesota guiding these new small emerging businesses. To my right, I have Mr. Glenn Seeger from Twin City Angels who wanted to speak to this point.
Mr. Seeger?
Yes. I'm here representing Twin Cities Angels. We're a angel fund of about 50 members.
Would you also introduce yourself?
My name is Glenn Seeger. Representing Twin Cities Angels, we're an angel fund of about 50 members based here in the Twin Cities. We make investments primarily in Minnesota, although we do see plans from the surrounding states. The vast majority of them are from here in Minnesota. We have a concern with the requirement that all of our members be natural persons. The reason is that occasionally we'll have people that want to be members, but as a corporation for their own reasons or as an IRA. But one of the things that we would really like to do, and we won't be able to do it under the current law, is that we would like to attract funds from outside of the state, from California or for the East Coast, that would like an opportunity to establish a footprint here inexpensively by being a member of our group and being able to benefit from our deal flow, attend our meetings, and do it less expensively as than if they had tried to establish those relationships on their own. So by disqualifying the entire group, because we may have one or two non-natural person members, it is going to significantly affect, it eliminates our access to the credit for all of those natural members. And so, but what we'd like to see is that at least the credit can go to the natural person members, even if it still cannot go to any member that is a corporation or a fund or funds or something along those lines. The credit, as we understand the proposal, is that it would still be available for natural person members, but not for the corporate members of our group.
Are there any questions? Representative Dill?
Well, thank you. I actually have a thank you very much for coming and your testimony. And I actually have a question for Representative Gunther, the chair.
Representative Gunther.
You know, this is what I really like about being on the committee, and it's the first year I've ever served on this. So my question to you, in your tenure in this committee as chairman, which has been a long time, plus or minus a couple of years in the middle, have you ever, is it uncommon that bills this significant with this amount of money come back for mid-course adjustments in years following?
It is very common. I think one thing I've noticed about the legislature in the years that I've been here is nothing's ever completed, and we don't have 4,000 good ideas every biennium. They're all rehashing of many old ones. So things like this do happen. We get involved in getting something passed that we think is a very worthy thing to do, and then we find out we can make it better. And I think that's what we're doing here.
Well, Representative Dill?
I think I agree with this. This is a significant investment. It's tough times for the state, tough times for taxpayers, but I think I agree with you. And just like in business, every day you wake up, you don't make mid-course corrections. You make minute-by-minute corrections so that you can stay competitive and keep the doors open. So I like your bill, Representative Mahoney.
Representative Clark?
I just have one last question. I'm still trying to understand this $2 million, $4 million. So when that was made to be those two different levels, was that an error? Is that what we're understanding? And now we're correcting mid-course, whatever you're going to call it. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark.
Mr. Nelson.
It's hard for me to say whether it was an error, or I think really what happened with this bill is last year there was one version. It went to the tax committee. The tax committee staff was asked to make some changes, and in those changes it ended up that there were some inconsistencies. Okay. And this is sort of a major inconsistency that wasn't caught at the time.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Clark.
Just my final question would be then, if we allow that, do we know that we're getting more jobs for that extra $2 million?
Representative Clark, what this will do is actually open up the program a little bit to somewhat larger corporations. And I would probably ask Mr. Ruth to speak to this, but my experience would be that as a company grows, it's probably more likely to be hiring more people than at earlier stages.
Well,
Mr. Ruth?
Yes, thank you. There's two points to this. Number one, we today have 7 full-time employees here in Minnesota. The average rate, not including our executives, is $70,000 annual. Okay, so we're paying a very, very good wage. We, assuming we can continue to do investments, get investments, we'll double our size within the next year. We're pretty confident of that. But we're also going to, again, double the size of our investment in our subcontractors that are Minnesota companies that are going to have to hire people to do the work that we're not going to do. I mean, it's just making it capital efficient for us. If I went out and built my own manufacturing facility, it might cost me $10 million to build it. So I can be capitally conservative by using an outsourced company who's got employees and can hire employees with their building.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Clark,
I think that means that there's going to be some more jobs produced, but not necessarily by you, but more by your subcontractors. Is that your answer?
Yes.
Mr. Ruth?
Yes and yes.
All right. Are any further questions? All right. Representative Mahoney, would you like to...
I'd like to renew my motion for passage and to the tax committee. It's a good bill. Vote for it, please.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Bill gets moved to tax committee. Next, we'll have House File 667, the Conservation Corps of Minnesota. Representative Mahoney, if you'd like to bring your testifiers down. I just ask that you guys be as brief as possible so that we can stay on track here.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would move for possible inclusion in House File 667 in the jobs bill. It is a bill that puts $500,000 into the base for the Minnesota Conservation Corps, which is a, you know what, I'm not going to try and explain it. I'm going to have Lynn Price, because I've explained this bill a couple of times. I'll let Lynn explain what the Minnesota Conservation Corps is.
All right, Mr. Price, would you please introduce yourself into the mic so we can have that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Lynn Price. I'm Executive Director of Conservation Corps Minnesota. We changed our name a couple of years ago. We used to be called Minnesota Conservation Corps. Now we're Conservation Corps Minnesota, and I can explain that if you wish, that name change. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. I've asked that in your packet you receive our old annual report. Our new one is still being formulated. I call your attention to it because I'm going to make some references to pages in this annual report that will do a better job of explaining some of the things that I'm going to talk about with the limited time that we have here. But I would call to your attention underneath the picture, the text there, it says the Conservation Corps provides meaningful work for young people in managing natural resources, conserving energy, responding to disasters, and leading volunteers. Not only do we provide training in resource management, safety, job readiness, and technical skills, we help young people develop personal responsibility, a strong work ethic, and greater awareness of environmental stewardship. Conservation Corps Minnesota once upon a time was embedded in the Department of Natural Resources, and during the administration of Governor Ventura, the funding for this particular program was reduced. There were some visionary people who were involved in this program who said, this is too good to let disappear. We need to keep this program alive, so let's form a friends group and let's have this become a 501c3 nonprofit, and we've been in that status since 2003. I've been the executive director since 2005. In 2005, when I came there, we had engaged in these various programs, and there were really only two at the time, probably 160 young people, high school age youngsters, about 85 young adults, about 45 to 50. A lot of people didn't think we'd survive. But thanks to the support of a lot of partners that we do business with, support from the legislature, we've been able to grow this organization so that today in 2011, we will actually field over 400 young people and youth in a variety of places across the state of Minnesota. The job skills that we provide require a lot of training. An individual who is 18 to 25 years of age, who we refer to as young adults, will probably spend over 1,700 hours of work in the field. And when I say in the field, they're all over the state of Minnesota doing a variety of tasks. And of that amount of work, 20% is devoted to training because we are a training youth development organization. Our training takes on a variety of types. The chart that is a single page that's in your packet describes what those types of training are. We are here today because we need help, since we've grown so much and there's stress on our sources of revenue. We need help trying to continue the quality of the training that we've been able to give. These young people, many of whom are going to go on to a career pathway of natural resource work, maybe for an agency, maybe for a private enterprise, get a really extensive amount of experience. First of all, we're in a crew model. And as you know, it's good to have employees who are capable of working and cooperating with other people, no matter what the organization is. Our crew is for our young adults, range from 4 to 5 people, depending on where they're working. They're going to do a lot of natural resource hands-on work, so they're going to get trained in chainsaw work, power equipment, not heavy-duty equipment, but small hand tool power equipment. They're all certified to be wildfire fighters because we have a special collaboration with the Department of Natural Resources to respond to wildfires, and we have done that some years very extensively, other years not so extensively. They are going to be eligible to become fire jumpers with a bit more training. Many of them have gone on to do that. Because we do a lot of work with exotics, we train them and certify them for application of herbicides. So in the middle of the single sheet there, when you look under field skills, I've been describing some of those kinds of real specific types of trainings that these individuals get. But they also get a lot of general work career readiness kinds of things, which you see in the left-hand column, and then employee health-related training as well. Again, 20% of our time for them in our program, we want to have them be engaged in training. But I'll be honest with you, every day when they go out and do their work, they're probably getting some training. If they go to Representative Dill's district, where we do extensive amount of work because he has so much public land, that's our forte, to work on public lands using our crews. They might be doing carpentry work in a park one day, and the next day they're out doing trail maintenance work. The next month they might be doing shoreline restoration. It's all over the map. So whatever that crew is going to do on that given day, in that given week, or that given month, that's more training that they're able to get. What happens to these Corps members when they leave? The bottom of that single sheet shows you that about 39% of them, and this is an average over the last 6 years or so, will go back to school. One of the features of this program is that all of these young people are enrolled in AmeriCorps. AmeriCorps is like a domestic Peace Corps, which provides lots of benefits to us as an organization, but to them as well. They're eligible, while they're working, to earn what's called an AmeriCorps Education Award. It's equivalent to a Pell Grant, which today is worth about $5,300. So many of them, when they get done with our program, say, you know what? I want to go back and get my master's degree, or I want to go back and get trained for this specific kind of work. They now have a cache of money through a voucher to attend any college, university, technical school in the country and go back and pursue that further education. That's a big step in an individual's development as a good worker. Some of them come back and work for us. Some of them go to other AmeriCorps programs. Some of them get actually jobs, which is wonderful. The job market's lousy, as you well know. The young people in this age group have the highest unemployment rate in the country. You've heard that before. I've attended a couple of your meetings, and I've heard people testify to that. This is a way to engage some of these people in gainful employment, but give them that next step to go on and get that additional training and experience that they need. Because we exist, I'll wrap this up, because we exist, we're able to leverage dollars from many other places. As I mentioned, we get AmeriCorps funding. The AmeriCorps funding relates to that Pell Grant, which many of them spend here in Minnesota at colleges and universities and technical schools. That's an injection into our economy. They go live across the state, so they're living in a local community, paying rent, buying groceries. Our organization has a fleet of trucks because that's what we use to do our work. We buy gas, we buy groceries. I can't recall last summer how many checks I wrote out to Zups food market in Ely, Minnesota, because we had 40 core members who lived either in Grand Marais, theirs is up there too, and in Ely, and they bought groceries because they would go into the woods for 8 days, live in a tent, work together, work on restoring a trail, and then come out for 6 days and either stay there or go back to their home places. But they're spending those dollars in those local economies. We provide through AmeriCorps insurance for these young people if they wish to buy it. That's another benefit. We spend money buying boots, personal protection equipment for firefighting. We are spending money as an organization to support this program. So I just want to call these things to your attention. I can't tell you, the stars are lined up. That previous group that was in here talking about deaf individuals, that young man was in our program. I remembered him as soon as he said, I came to this country and I was in the Conservation Corps program. He learned a different sign language system than American Sign Language. And here, two summers ago or last summer, I was in the North Shore. There was a crew doing a project at Sugarloaf at their educational community there. I think the new representative on the committee knows this place on the North Shore, north of Two Harbors. And there was a deaf crew leader and this deaf young man, and they were unusual because they were having trouble trying to communicate with each other because they didn't have the same signing. Every summer, with our 85 high school age youngsters in our residential 8-week program, we try to put 15% to 20% of those spots for deaf and hard of hearing youngsters. It's a tradition in our core. It's wonderful. There's this interchange, this interface between the deaf community and the hearing community, and it's remarkable to see what happens to young people in that situation. Well, I could go on here for a long time, but I'm here to ask you for your support for an opportunity to tap into this fund to help us continue to give these opportunities to youth and young adults. It's a program that's got good results. Every year we file a report with the committees that normally do our jurisdictional general fund dollars. It's there in the House in the Legislative Reference Library. Representative Dill, Representative Gunther, Representative Paymar, Representative Scalzi, Representative Clark. They're the only folks I know that I've talked to before, and I know some of them have had constituents who have been in our program, and they know something about our program. Perhaps they could attest to it or answer questions about it if you need.
Thank you, Mr. Price. All right, we have a question from Representative Dill.
No question. I just want to tell you, I serve on the Environment Committee for all the 9 years I've been here, and this morning we basically gutted their funding in the Environment Committee budget. I mean, the target is so tough there that something has to give. So they got gutted. Now, let me tell you what really happens. We get an incredible amount of impact with this program. Okay, say it's parochial. I got millions and millions of acres of public land, and Senator Price said that's where they do a lot of work. But that's where a lot of people come, and a lot of people come to get the benefit of that. Tell you about the kids, the young people. I shouldn't call them kids. I'm getting older. I feel like they're kids. But I see them everywhere. They're so identifiable. They're even more identifiable than EMTs and first responders with their gear on and all that. These guys are really identifiable. I see them on the North Shore. I see them in the most ungodly places you've ever seen, that if you were on a canoe trip, you wouldn't want to be there. They're living in tents. They're getting rained on. The mosquitoes are eating them alive. If they don't be careful, the bears are chasing them out of the tents. Everything you can imagine happens to those kids. And let me tell you one thing. All you have to do is look at that back picture on that paper, and that tells the story. I have seen them hundreds of times in the Zup food markets, in the different places, at gas stations, and every time I see these crews, whether it's 1, 5, 10, or 15, or however big it is, that's what they look like right there. They have a smile on their face. In full disclosure, I went into the Northwoods Cafe last summer, and there was a bunch there, and somebody recognized me and asked me to sit down, and they bought my lunch. So I got to... I got to disclose that.
Oh, man.
All right, Representative Dill, we'll stop you right there.
Stop.
Right?
And, but, right?
The problem is that Representative Dill, they bought you lunch. You should have bought them lunch for all the work.
Well, they offered first. They insisted. But nonetheless, this is an incredible program. I hope that we can find some way to help them, because the impact for the state, not only for people in my district, my people, the people that we have, Carly and I have, we got all the places we need to go roam. We can find all the places. We can keep care of our own rivers and all that stuff. But they really make that, they make the gap closer between the people that need to come up there and recreate and the people that live there. Len, you do a great job. I hope that we can find the money, especially since we gutted you today in the environment, if that bill were to ever pass.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dill, that's...
Mr. Bryce.
Very appreciated. Thank you for that eloquent endorsement.
All right. Representative Clark?
I just had a technical question. I hadn't heard this before, but I heard you talk about the youth applying herbicides in some way. What is that? What does that kind of work?
Mr. Price?
We do extensive exotic invasive non-native species removal, i.e. buckthorn, for example. And so some of the ways that you have to treat this to keep it hopefully in check is to use things like Garlon, and so that's a type of material that we use. We're not into heavy chemical application. We don't want to expose our core members to that. Garlic mustard is another big invasive species, so we've been asked to do a lot of that removal too. Honestly, we don't want to have somebody come in and work for a year just removing non-natives and exotics, but you know, there are several different ways to attack the problem. We do it in conjunction with whoever the collaborator partner is.
Representative Clark?
Maybe you could talk to me about this later, but I see Monsanto is one of your donors, so are you using their products?
I don't know the answer to that. Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, I do not know the direct answer to
could
that.
Could you find that out for me?
I certainly will.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair.
Yep. Mr. Mahoney?
One last thing. Very short. I just want you to look on the inside of the page. I am showing my age here. Look on the left side and look at the corporate foundation support, and then look down at the matching donors that support these programs. I mean, that's the who's who of Minnesota. I mean, it must be important. Blue Cross Blue Shield, IBM, Monsanto, Best Buy, Bremer Bank. I mean, you can read it. I mean, this means something. I mean, there's a lot of programs that mean something. And then to have the fellow from Sri Lanka in here talking about how he's going, well, trying to talk about how he was doing it and moving on in his life is just, I don't see how we can have a more compelling story than what we've seen here.
Representative Kiefer?
I just wanted to say hi, Senator Price, and thank you for your work and your continued service.
Thank you.
He's my constituent.
All right, Mr. Price. All right, Representative Mahoney?
Thank you.
Would you like to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just like to finish this up. There's many reasons that Representative Dill should have carried this bill, but in my district is the memorial to the CCC, which is the grandparent to this particular organization. And Mr. Price and his organization, it sounded like they just did work up in the North Woods. They do work across the state, from helping with sandbagging at rivers that overflow to riprap or shoreline restoration in my district, in multiple districts across the state. And that's really kind of where I figured out who this group was, the monument and then the shoreline restoration of Lake Phelan. But as I in here in the packet is a list of their projects. They do multiple jobs across the state. They affect many, many districts. I feel honored to be able to carry their bill. So, members, I would ask that the House file 667, am I getting that number right? 667, be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Next up, we have House file 112, Representative Barrett. If you'd like to come forward, and if you have anyone that's going to be, I move that we lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, House File 112.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barrett.
Members of the committee, I will try to keep my comments short.
maybe 20, 25 minutes, if that's okay.
Well, how about we not quite that long?
Very good. Very good, Mr. Chair. I am Representative Bob Barrett. I represent the good folks of Chisago County, which is right north of Forest Lake to the east of 35. We are a bedroom community in many respects. We have very low commercial industrial tax base in our county. And we would like to have Taylor's Falls, which is a community right on the St. Croix River, right on the border with Wisconsin, be included in an existing program, what's called the Border City Development Zone Program. And so House File 112 attempts to do that. The Border City Development Zone statute has been in place for many years and allows cities who are economically disadvantaged by their close proximity to a neighboring low-tax city on the other side of the border to designate all or a part of their city as a border city development zone. The purpose of the bill and the existing statute is simple: to encourage economic development and job creation. The bill also funds up to $100,000 to be used for property tax exemptions for either tax relief, property tax relief, or the like. Just explain the bill a little bit more, at least our situation. We, again, are right on the border with Wisconsin. I had some maps drawn up and some information for you. Unfortunately, they are in black and white. The color version is much prettier. But if you'd like to see that, I'd be happy to pass it around. Taylor's Falls is right on the border. There's a 220-foot bridge separating that in St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin. St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin is the kind of the bigger brother in this situation. They have a Kentucky Fried Chicken, Walmart, Menards, County Market, and various other manufacturing. And, you know, to add insult to injury, they have a Dairy Queen, and we do not.
Oh.
So, I've been here, well, actually, I have not been here in front of this committee, but at the suggestion of Representative Mahoney, he asked that this bill get referred to this committee from the Property Tax Division. And in that committee, I was here with Chris Eng, Executive Director of Economic Development for Chisago County, and Mayor Mike Buchheit, and they provided much very detailed testimony on what they'd like to accomplish. But in general, what they'd like to do is Mayor Mike has a industrial park that he is in the process of putting in place. He worked with Xcel Energy, who bought a larger parcel for their purpose, and then purchased through some land swapping with the DNR. Mayor Mike was able to get about 8 acres for economic development. So what we'd like to do is incent people from the other side of the river over to Taylor's Falls. In a town called Osceola, which is about 10 miles down the road, they have about 20 businesses in their industrial park, of which about 17 are from Minnesota, who have chosen Wisconsin for various reasons to relocate. So what this bill would do would provide money to draw those and other businesses back over the border to Minnesota.
All right. Are there any questions for Representative Barrett? Representative Clark.
What is the cost of this bill, Representative Barrett?
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The bill allocates $100,000. The cost of it, well, the fiscal note is $11,000 because it's assumed over a 9-year period. No money would be allocated no money would be used for any purpose until a business actually relocated. So once they relocated, built their business, developed some property tax, then we would then rebate or refund money for that property tax at the discretion of the city of Taylor's Falls.
Representative Baird, is there any other cities, so maybe like La Crescent, Minnesota, or some other border cities that have, you know, La Crosse, Wisconsin, or some other cities, does this exist in other places?
Sure, that's a very good question, Mr. Chair. A lot of the cities, there's about 5 cities right now a part of this program. All of them are on the west side of the state, Breckenridge, East Grand Forks, Moorhead, and a couple others are also in this program.
All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
I didn't quite get finished with my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well,
I cut you off.
I just wanted to ask the representative. You were talking about St. Croix Falls, but St. Croix Falls, are they? They don't have a drive-in root beer stand, though, like Taylor's Falls, do they?
No, they don't. Actually, Taylor's Falls does. With full disclosure, I meant the Dairy Queen comment as a joke. Taylor's Falls actually does have a root beer stand. It's called the drive-in.
That's why I mentioned it. I just thought people should know that there are some amenities there that are.
Yes, indeed. And I apologize if I misrepresented it. I
It's okay. I just want to give you credit for having a pretty unique. It's a unique root beer stand. If you go through Taylor's Falls, you probably don't want to miss that.
Right, and I actually wasn't sure I should use that joke because I know the gentleman Wade Vitalis is the owner, and so if he were to hear me on TV here or see me, I don't think he'd like my joke.
Yes, Robert, we like integrity here, Representative Barrett, so thank you.
It's a beautiful city, though. Taylor's Falls is right on the river, and Interstate Park is on both sides of the river. And so it really is just a very nice place for people to travel to. I think Interstate Park is one of the most traveled and used state parks in the state. And so we're trying to encourage the activity that's already there by adding to it by having a thriving commercial industrial base.
All right. Are there any other questions? All right. I move House File 112 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All right. Thank you, Representative Barrett.
Appreciate it.
All right. All right. Next up, we have House File 1076, Representative Mike Lemire. If you'd like to take the stand, if you have any folks going to be speaking on behalf of the bill, if they join you.
Mr. Chair, I move House File 1076 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. My name is Mike Lemire. I'm state representative for Morrison and Crow Wing County, and what we have here is an agency bill from the Department of Labor and Industry, and there's provisions in the bill that are considered technical changes. In Section 1, the First Amendment strikes a sentence that should have been deleted last year. The fee for an independent contractor exemption certificate is in 1.8.723 subdivision 14, and the residential building contractor license fee is in 326B.092. The amendment continues to permit a combined application. The Second Amendment adds a sentence that permits a final penalty to be filed as a judgment without notice or additional proceedings. This is consistent with similar laws related to penalties and judgments. Under Section 2, this adds a cite to the authority for enforcing the Safe Patient Handling Act by assessing a penalty. The addition gives employers who violate the act the right to contest the violation that the penalty is based upon. And then under Section 3, changes the date that triggers a 180-day count to the effective date of rules that adopt or amend the state building code. Currently, the trigger date is when the rules are filed with the Secretary of State, which is a difficult date for people affected or interested in the rulemaking to determine. Changing the date to a publication date will make it easier to determine the effective date of the rules. And under Sections 4 and 5, it makes changes to the Contractor Recovery Fund. First, it clarifies what the costs are, excluding from the owner's or lessee's actual and direct out-of-pocket loss. And the second change makes it clear that the DLI or the owner or lessee can appeal the decision of an administrative law judge. That's pretty much the context of the bill, Mr. Chair, and we're open to any questions at this time.
All right, are there any questions? All right, with that, Representative Lemire,
I renew my motion to move House File 1076 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Jobs and Economic Development Omnibus Bill.
All right. Okay. All right, we're adjourned.